Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about Tech Tent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to Tech Tent, your essential weekly guide to everything that's happening in the technology world. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones, and this week we're talking about another major cyber attack and trying to work out who's behind it. We'll also discuss that record-breaking fine slapped on Google by the European Commission and hear about Germany's new law on taking down extremist content. With me to help guide us through all these stories and more is BBC technology correspondent Mark Ward, a big expert on cybersecurity. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Rory.
Good to have you. And another cyber expert is my special guest, tech writer and old friend of Tech Tent, Kate Bevan, is with us in the studio. Welcome back, Kate.
Well, less of the old, if you don't mind.
I will try to be a bit more tactful in future. Here's a flavour of what's in the show.
Europe has constantly been in a position of feeling jealous that it doesn't have a Google.
The problem with cybersecurity is you don't always have the data or the training data to be able to pre-identify the sort of threat types that you'd expect.
The potential for abusing a law like the Netzwerkdurchsetzungsgesetz in Germany is pretty high.
All of that soon. First, though, another major cyber attack ricocheted around the world this week, affecting companies ranging from the shipping giant Maersk to the advertising business WPP. But this time, it seemed to be focused on Ukraine. Transport, banks and the country's power distributor were all affected. Alex Ryabchin is a member of Ukraine's parliament.
We didn't have a lot of damage, so our critical infrastructure wasn't involved in the accident. But definitely the volume of the attack, the amount of the enterprises or the state-owned firms hit by this attack is enormous.
So what are we to conclude about the nature of this attack? Mark Ward has been writing all sorts of stories about it on the BBC site all week. Mark, let's get one thing out of the way. What are we calling it? I've seen it called all sorts of names.
I think that's part of the problem. I think it's been called Petya because it's based on a virus that was around last year. It's been called GoldenEye. It's been called non-Petya, Petya Rap, Eternal Petya, Nietia. So take your pick, really, but I think we'll stick with Petya.
And how does it work? And what are the similarities and differences to that huge WannaCry attack that we covered so extensively?
Well, I think the big similarity is that it's a strange mix of sophisticated amateurish like that WannaCry was. On the one hand, you've got the amateurish encryption that really doesn't work and the cashing out system as well, the Bitcoin payments, and people ain't going to get their data back, unfortunately, even if they've handed over some money. And on the other side, there's just the way it spread once it got inside companies was pretty sophisticated and looks like it had quite a lot of testing. So there's a kind of weird mix there going on.
And it is ransomware in theory, but it's actually useless ransomware because it destroys your data. There's no way you need to pay up or can do anything about it because you won't get anything back.
Well, that's right. I mean, it encrypts data a couple of ways, and I think one of the ways it does it, you can get your data back. However, most of the times you're going to get hit by it, you're not going to get your data back. And like I say, the gut people behind it have gone to ground. They're just not going to give you any keys.
And actually, one of the other problems with this is that the owners of the email provider shut down the email address. So even if you were going to pay over your Bitcoin, you couldn't email the people behind the attack and say, OK, I've paid up my Bitcoin, please send me my decryption key, because they were never going to get it. The email address was shut down.
So, Kate Bevan, and what can we conclude about who's behind it? We never know who's behind these things, but there are clues, aren't there?
We never know. I mean, I think trying to actually attribute it is probably on a hiding to nothing, even if somebody claims responsibility for it. The chatter is that because it hit Ukraine quite hard and took out things like airports, that it was aimed at Ukraine by what's euphemistically known as a state actor, and everybody else was rather collateral damage.
And how worried should we be about this one rather than WannaCry? WannaCry was spectacular, particularly here in this country, because it actually stopped the health service, the hospitals and so on, from working for a while. So it looked much more serious. But this one looks slightly more professional?
Again, it's chatter. We don't know. Yes, possibly, because as Mark points out, it's much more kind of effective in the way it works. It scrambled stuff, it wiped stuff in a way that you can't get back. So that's really going to cripple an organisation that's hit by it.
And Mark, one thing it had in common with WannaCry, it used one of those hacking tools stolen from the National Security Agency again, didn't it?
It did. And I think some of the analysis has pointed some other slightly worrying things about it as well, in that the methods it uses internally haven't really been exploited that much. And it's one of those things that, you know, hackers like a good trick. And you know, they're saying that, unfortunately, this could be the start of lots more things like this.
Yeah, we're going to see more of these, I think.
Well, that's a cheery note to end that particular discussion on. Now, if you type the name of a product, say leather shoes, into Google, the first thing you'll see is a box with a series of adverts. This is the Google shopping service. And this week, the European Commission decided it involved an abuse of the search giant's power. Here's the Competition Commissioner, Margareta Vesteia.
Google has abused its market dominance in its search engine by promoting its own shopping comparison service in its search results and demoting its competitors. What Google has done is illegal under EU antitrust rules. It has denied other companies the chance to compete on the merits and to innovate. And most importantly, it has denied European consumers the benefits of competition, genuine choice and innovation.
Now, Google said it respectfully disagreed with the Commission's conclusion and was considering an appeal. But was this a case of a regulator finally acting against a dangerously powerful web giant? Or was it about European resentment of superior American technology and innovation? According to the digital media expert Professor Jeff Jarvis, author of What Would Google Do?, it was the latter.
It's amazing that we love success and then we hate success. And if you get too successful, we want to bring it back down. I don't think that Google has done anything illegal with its power except provide amazing, great services for free. I think Europe has constantly been in a position of feeling jealous that it doesn't have a Google. But frankly, you're not going to get there by regulating and passing protectionist legislation. The only way to create your own Google is by investing and innovating.
Now, just a minute. You said it's done nothing illegal. The European Commission has said, and lots of competition lawyers agree, that it has done something illegal. It's used its dominant position in one market, and it is extremely dominant, to move into other markets. And this is just one example of that predatory behaviour, which all regulators surely should be on the lookout for.
But show me the media company that doesn't promote its own stuff. What it's doing is putting up its own ads, selling its ads. That's exactly what every media company does and what media companies are jealous about. And that's why media companies in Europe used their political clout to force the EU to go after Google.
It wasn't just media companies. It was rival shopping comparison services. And on a whole range of activities, we've seen complaints about this behavior. Isn't it time that somebody took a stand?
Of course, competitors aren't going to like it, and they're going to try to use regulators to their will. But let's put this in perspective. I use practically every Google service there is. I can barely remember the last time that I used Google shopping services. Can you?
I can, yeah. This is about search. And there is data. There's plenty of data out there. There's a recent article by the experts at Search Engine Land, which says this has turned into a very lucrative business for
Google. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's an advertising service for shopping. And yes, it's promoted. And that's the way that business operates.
Are you not in danger of seeing this from a very kind of equally patriotic American angle? We've got four.
Then are you implying that this is an anti-American decision, Rory?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is that there are concerns not just in Europe, but also globally and in many parts of America, about the sheer power of these new virtual monopolies that spring up.
All I'm trying to say is that this, the same concern has been there for years about us in media. And now that we're losing our hegemony over the national and international conversation, we get our backs up and think that that was rightfully ours. A competitor comes along that offers advertisers a better deal. And yes, they get a lot of business from us because they do it better. That's competition. That's capitalism. Bothers me here is that there is, I think, little to no evidence of harm. The shopping thing is minor. It's nothing. Is this worth $2.7 billion in harm? Really? Really?
Professor Jeff Jarvis, you can see which side he's on. Kate Bevan, a special guest. I was trying to get in there to stem the flow and say, you know, 100 years ago, American regulators basically split up the monopoly oil companies when their power seemed too much. Is it time for a bit of regulatory action against the likes of Google, or is this just European jealousy?
I think it's important to create space for smaller competitors. I think Jeff is being very disingenuous there and also slightly defensive, because actually he neglects to notice that this regulation also protects small American companies that want to get into that space. If you've got something that huge, it's a real disincentive to anybody to come in and compete. You know, you might think, oh, I could set up a really good internet shopping search business here. Then you go, actually, Google just owns that, I'm not going to bother. And the end result is you disincentivize small businesses, which capitalists are supposed to love, from coming into that space, and other businesses wither away on the vine, and you end up with a giant galumphing, monopoly.
But it does fit into a pattern, doesn't it? I mean, more than 10 years ago, Europe took on Microsoft in a way that US regulators were less inclined to do. And nowadays, it looks like that was a bit, you know, a bit out of date, that move. The world moved on.
I think there's a sense that that Europe is quite slow on these. I mean, the concern about Google's dominance over shopping search has been around for a long time, and it does take a long time for the EU to get to come around to delivering a verdict on this. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't do it.
And we can expect more action from Europe on various fronts. There's more action possibly against Google and against other companies, Apple and Facebook and so on. You're listening to Tech 10 on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Catlin-Jones. In a moment, can AI be used to battle cybercrime? First, though, let's look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Mark Ward. Mark, first of all, here's a phone call I got a couple of years ago.
My name is Michael from the Service and Maintenance Department of Windows Computer.
And what do you do for Windows Computer?
We come to know about some problem in your computer.
Now, lots of people may have had similar calls, and if they hang on long enough, they can end up handing over large sums of money. It's basically a scam. So, Mark, explain what's happened this week in the battle against this type of fraud.
Well, what's happened is in the UK, four people were arrested, two in Surrey and two in Tyneside, who were coordinating the UK end of that global scam. It catches out a huge number of people. Certainly, I think in the UK, there's about 35,000 reports a year to sort of fraud agencies. In the US, Microsoft gets 10,000 complaints a month about similar kinds of scams. It's big business, about $1.5 billion is people hand over every year. So I think it's part of a global action to try and clean these things up, because they tend to target older people, and generally people lose quite a lot of money for fixing problems that simply aren't there.
Yeah, the average loss I learnt this week was getting on for $1,000. Isaac Asimov came up with his laws of robotics. Now there's a modern version?
Well, kind of, yeah. It's a report from the Royal Society and the British Academy, and it's looking at all the ways that these autonomous systems we're starting to use, what they're doing to us, really, and how they should be governed in some respects. And now they're saying that they should be governed by just one principle, which is that humans should flourish, which is the kind of, they should be done for our benefit rather than to us, if you see what I mean. So if they're getting our data, then whatever they do with it should help us rather than hinder us.
Kate, you got some laws of robotics?
Well, there's the classic one, of course, that's been added fairly recently, which I think anybody that likes pop will recognise. A robot should never give you up, let you down, run around or desert you.
I'll remember that one. And Mark, as if building electric cars and space rockets was not enough, Elon Musk has got yet another new mission.
He has, yes. This is a boring company, but it's actually quite interesting. So he's floated the idea of fixing LA's congestion problem by digging tunnels, effectively. And they've done some sort of prototypes of how this might work. And this week they started actually digging a tunnel, and they've got permission from the LA mayor to go ahead and do it. Bizarrely, the enormous machine, weighs 1,200 tonnes, is 400 feet long, that's going to do it, called Godot. You're going to have to wait a while for Godot to get
boom,
because it's going to take about 20 years to complete this.
Where do you stand? He's an extraordinary figure, Elon Musk. I'm kind of torn between just admiration for what he's achieved. I mean, when you see that rocket landing back, the reusable rocket, the electric car business. But some of these ideas seem, frankly, a bit barking mad.
Do you know what? That LA thing reminds me of the Victorian entrepreneurs who built the tube, and they were doing it in a completely unorganised, unregulated way. And we've kind of benefited from it, but at the same time you think, do you want multi-squillionaires just spending money according to their whims? You know, we've got this amazing system whereby we take money from people who earn it kind of in proportion, and we spend it for the greater good of the country. So, you know, perhaps there's something into that idea.
And it's a system for moving cars around underground when maybe they could be people could be put in buses and you could call it public transport.
I know, exactly. And the other thing also strikes me about, would you really want to be building tunnels under LA, which is on the San Andreas Fault?
Yes, watch this space. Let's see how that one proceeds. Now, another clash between American and European ideas of how the tech world should work. Just a few hours ago, German MPs voted in favour of the controversial Netzwerkdurchsetzungsgesetz.
How was that again, Rory?
I won't say that again. It's a law that obliges social media sites to delete illegal content within 24 hours or face fines of up to 50 million euros. That's about $57 million. Our reporter in Berlin, Joe Miller, joins us. Joe, take us through this law. I mean, it was very controversial, wasn't it?
Yeah, firstly, Rory, I must say you're doing a far better job on pronouncing that word than I can. And I've been reporting on this for quite a few months now.
My rusty German coming back.
Yeah, very useful indeed. Yes, it's been a very, very controversial law. And it's been controversial, really, since it was first drafted a few months ago. Now, a bit of context, this comes in the wake of several very, very high-profile cases of illegal hate speech in Germany, including one in which a very prominent Green MP was targeted with this post that claimed that she was sympathetic to a refugee who'd committed a murder in South Germany. It was completely false, the post. So the government came along with this proposal, which is very punitive, which fines social media companies up to 50 million euros if they fail to take things down within 24 hours. I went to visit a facility in Cologne that currently voluntarily polices the internet, and I spoke to a guy called Alexander Rabe, who has been working there for 15 years, or has been at the facility which has been working on this for 15 years. Listen to the concerns that he has. Listen to what he has to say.
It really takes time to look and to decide what is illegal. The potential for abusing a law like the Netzwerkdurchsetzungsgesetz in Germany is pretty high, and we see that there are a lot of countries, they are maybe not the best democracies in the world, are interested in this law draft right now, because they said, okay, look, this is a regulation system we maybe also could use for suppressing opposition opinions. What a fake news is or what hate speech is not as clear defined as we sometimes wish.
So quite a lot of opposition, even from those people who are working against the proliferation of hate speech online. So Why do you think this won? What were the arguments that persuaded lawmakers that this was a good idea?
Well, it won because it's very, very popular amongst the German public. This idea that big American companies mainly can run social networks in Germany, and the way the public sees it, you know, not properly police their sites and allow hate speech, etc., to be on it, is deeply, deeply unpopular here. Germany is a country that has very strict rules about libel, very strict rules about hate speech, and they wanted to see that enforced online as well. And Heiko Maas, the justice minister, said time and time again, he singled out Facebook and he said, look, the large platform operators, they won't fulfill their obligations on their own. The only way we can make them do that is by threatening them with big, big penalties. And that's why it went through.
And do we think there will be cases coming forward quite soon, or will this make the internet firms be that much more careful?
What remains to be seen, it only comes into effect in October, which is after the German elections. Originally, it was going to be coming into effect a lot earlier. And I've spoken to a few of the social networks, and they say they're just trying to work out how this is going to work. They're hiring more people, they're hiring lawyers. They're not sure where the jurisdiction of this law ends, because obviously a post that appears in a German newsfeed could come from anywhere in the world, and they're not entirely sure how that works. And also, they're sort of hoping that many human rights campaigners who are appealing this law, both in the German high courts and in Brussels, might be successful in at least changing it and adapting it and allowing a little bit more leeway in the law.
We'll have to watch how that develops, but a big change in the way the internet is policed, certainly in Germany. Joe Miller, thanks very much. Now, earlier we were talking about the latest cyber attack, but those in the front line in the battle against the hackers have a new weapon, artificial intelligence. At the COGEX AI conference in London recently, I ran into Emily Orton from the fast-growing cybersecurity firm Darktrace. She explained why this technology made a difference.
AI is actually a great technology to use for cybersecurity, because they have this problem of how do you find cyber threats inside very, very busy networks. And for cybersecurity, actually, it is being used. It has been used for the last 4 years. and successfully finding threats that wouldn't otherwise have been found because we never had a rule or a virus patch that would have covered that very novel attack. The problem with cybersecurity is you don't always have the data or the training data to be able to pre-identify the sort of threat types that you'd expect. So a lot of the machine learning that we see is called supervised. So it's actually using labeled data, which is learnt what is a threat, what's not a threat, and then it can work it out. The real breakthrough for us has been to use unsupervised machine learning where we don't know in advance what might be bad for one company or bad for another company. So it actually goes out with no assumptions, no training, and learns on itself. So that's a self-learning approach.
That's Emily Orton from Darktrace using AI in the battle against cybercriminals. Kate Bevan, AI seems to come with everything these days. I hardly get a press release that doesn't claim that AI is being used. Is it really becoming the hot new thing in cybersecurity? That's a field you follow very closely.
Yeah, what I think is interesting about it is it's a way of kind of preemptively automating tasks, if you like. So, for example, Google this week has announced that it's going to use AI to look through your Google photos for you and suggest people to tag and organise pictures into albums. So it's kind of deciding what you might want to do as a task there and automating it. Then we also saw another story that AI could have predicted the riots in London a few years ago. Half an hour before they happened, they reckoned that they could have pinpointed where the action was going to kick off the next hotspot half an hour before it actually happened. So again, it's that kind of using it to predict, using it to preemptively do things and proactively do things. The question is, at what point do you stop being comfortable with that?
Mark Ward, do the cybersecurity firms think that, you know, with these new tools, they're winning? Because quite often you're under the impression that they're really sort of behind the hackers, that the hackers are racing ahead and they're struggling to keep up.
Yeah, certainly it's true that, you know, every company says it's got AI, it's got machine learning. Every cybersecurity company says, yeah, let's throw more technology at it. But I think what I've seen is a lot of companies saying, actually, technology is not going to solve your problem because more often than not, it bumps up against human stupidity.
Yeah, humans are always your weak end point in anything.
What developments are taking place there? How are the cybersecurity firms using human techniques more usefully?
It's about training your humans. If you've got humans alert to what the threats are, what the behaviours are that cause problems, cause breaches and threats, then you're halfway there.
Mark, where's the next big threat coming from then? Will we next week be seeing a completely different technique used by the hackers maybe they'll be using AI themselves, of course. That's what you've got to
imagine.
Well,
that's what a lot of companies have said, oh, yeah, that's the next step, they're using AI. But I suspect they won't because they're quite lazy in some respects and they use what works. So I think if you see something big, then chances are you'll see something slightly smaller that uses the same kinds of techniques. So I think a lot of people are worried that, you know, this is the start of World War C, for the cyber, I'm afraid.
That's rather good. I'm going to steal that.
I like that. I'm going to steal that too.
And briefly, Kate, should we be optimistic or pessimistic about the battle against these cyber criminals?
I think we should always be optimistic because so far we've always managed to stop them eventually.
That's a good note on which to end. We were out of time. Thanks very much to my special guest, Kate Bevan. Thanks to my BBC colleague, Mark Ward. You can read all of his stories and mine at bbc.com/technology. Do take a look at our BBC Technology Facebook page. All sorts of stuff there. And join us again in the Tech Tent at the same time next week. Before you go, if you're enjoying Tech Tent, then allow me to recommend another offering from the BBC World Service. Just one question first. Do you eat? Well, if you answered yes, then this podcast is for you. The Food Chain is for farmers, foodies and fellow diners. Go to bbc.com/foodchain to find out more.